Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Several weeks ago, we had Peter Arwood and Michael Abdillah from the Space Association of Australia on the show talking about their trip to the Kennedy Space Center to find out what's happening there. Well, Peter is back, Michael unable to make it this evening. Welcome back to the Space Show, Peter.
Thanks, Andrew. It's good to be here. Mike sends his apologies.
Kennedy Space Center. You told us a little bit about what happened there. You've got some more information for us.
Sure. Well, we caught a couple more interviews at Kennedy Space Center. We may not get the chance to play them tonight, but part of the trip was also we went to this thing called Space Fest, which is an annual space enthusiast conference, and this year was held in Tucson, Arizona. And we did some interviews there as well. So they have different panels, discussion panels, there's artists, there's collectors, there's all sorts of things, and they have astronauts there that do signing and that type of thing. And one of the things that we stumbled across there was this group that, people may or may not know, the Apollo guidance computer was one of the first computers to be used in a flying vehicle. And back in the mid-60s, when it was developed, computers were the size of a room, right? And they realized that they needed a computer in order to be able to guide the spacecraft in space and in orbit, and particularly to be able to rendezvous with other spacecraft. So they set about designing a computer that could get this fit within a suitcase. they eventually did that, and they came up with the Apollo guidance computer, and it literally was the size of a suitcase. And they had one of these at Space Fest, and the Apollo guidance computer was used both in the command module, which is the module that the astronauts took off from the moon in and eventually landed back on the Earth, splashed down. But there was also a virtually identical one in the lunar module. And the lunar module was the first fly-by-wire vehicle using this guidance computer. So back then, none of the aircraft you flew around with as a commercial passenger, whatever, it was fly-by-wire. Just about every aircraft these days are. And that was the first fly-by-wire vehicle, and very quickly after that, the technology was adapted to be able to be used in aircraft and other flying vehicles. So it really pushed ahead the computer technology of the day. And at the Space Fest, there was a company there that are building replicas, functional replicas of the Apollo guidance computer, which is not like a laptop or an iPad or anything like that. These things, they've got a keyboard and a display which has got basically just a few numbers, and you had to enter verbs and nouns to get these programs to be running. And they're building these replicas. But what they're also doing is sponsoring this project to restore and get running again an original block two computer that somebody had finally located in the mid-70s. And we actually met up with a gentleman there who was not even born when the Apollo program was gone, but he's a computer engineer, and he works on rocket guidance systems. And he, out of a project of his own and a few other people's funding, setting in place the objective to be able to restart this computer and have it running by the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 in July of next year. So I did a quite a detailed interview with him. So if you would like to go to that interview now, his name is Mike Stewart.
And we're talking to Mike Stewart, who is sitting here at Space Fest working on an actual Block 2 Apollo guidance computer. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Really good to be here.
So you've got some white gloves on, and you're working on this computer, which looks like it's from the 60s, and I assume it is. What exactly are you doing?
So right now, I'm taking one of the power supplies out of the computer. There are some factory tuning resistors that set the voltage levels in this computer. We don't have the procedures that they use to set the values for those resistors. We don't really have any idea what range of values they can be. So I'm going to take this out and take some pictures of it, because there aren't any pictures of one of these out of the computer, and then take some measurements.
So you'll be recording the voltages and circuits within that module, or
just resistances today. There isn't any power applied to the computer at the moment. We are looking into the possibility of powering this on sometime in the next year, but we have a lot of work to do before then.
So for people listening on radio, it's very difficult. This is a block of metal with probably 30 modules bolted into them. And tell me what they are. And we had a look at it yesterday, flipped over. What's going on here?
So 24 of these modules contain 120 integrated circuits each. Every single integrated circuit is a dual three-input NOR gate. So this computer was designed entirely with NOR gates. The backside is a big mess of blue wires that interconnects all the modules. Every module has, I think, 268 pins going to the backplane, and there's 24 of them. So there's a whole lot of wires back there. And then there's five interface modules that do signal-level conversion and interfacing to the rest of the spacecraft. And then two power supplies.
So yesterday it was flipped over, and I saw you with a laptop computer and a couple of electrodes or electrical connectors, and I think you said you were mapping sort of the paths of the circuits?
That's right, yeah. We have mostly complete schematics for this computer, but not fully complete. So what I was doing yesterday was I was tracing out all of the connections that we don't know from the available schematics. So a lot of that was in the erasable memory. One of the big ones is the main spacecraft connector, which is 360 pins. We knew probably about half of those. And then all of the internal connectors going between the logic tray and the memory tray, there's 240 pins there that we didn't know any of. And there's probably somewhere around 180 pins going between the memory tray and the core rote memories that we also didn't know anything about. So the task yesterday was to map all of that out, and I was successful. I think we know what every pin does now.
So this is the Apollo guidance computer, and there was two of those. There's one in the command module and one in the lunar module. They're virtually the same.
They are completely identical. The only difference between them is what program they have plugged into them.
And so let's sort of put it into modern terms. How many gigabytes is this unit, and what's its speed of processor?
All right. So this thing has 2,048 words of RAM, where a word is 15 bits. So it doesn't map to bytes directly. So 2,048 words of RAM, 36 kilowords of program memory, ROM. And the processor speed, it has a 2 megahertz crystal that's divided down in half before it runs into any logic circuits. So it runs off of basically a 1 megahertz clock. It takes 12 of those clock cycles to do a memory cycle, and it normally takes 2 to 3 memory cycles to execute an instruction. So when you calculated it all out, you get an instruction rate of about 20 to 30 kilohertz.
So this is this would have been the computer that created the famous 1201 and 1202 alarms.
1201.
Roger,
1201 alarm.
1201
alarm.
Yes.
Tell me how that worked.
So, there was a design flaw in the lunar module and its power supplies. So there are two separate, going off the top of my head here, so I might have some numbers wrong. There are two separate, 240 hertz AC power supplies. One that powered the rendezvous radar, and one that powered the coupling data unit, which did the conversions between the angle of the radar and the AGC. So what happened was when they powered up the rendezvous radar, there is an incredibly small chance, on the order of milliseconds, maybe microseconds, where the phase of the two AC power supplies can be such that it's seen by the coupling data unit as the radar jittering back and forth really, really quickly. So The power supplies were frequency locked, but not phase locked. So on 11, they just got extremely unlucky and powered it up at just the wrong microsecond. So the coupling data unit, the CDU, was seeing the radar jitter back and forth. And the way the AGC works is on its main connector, the way it gets angle information is it has two digital pins that are basically just a plus count and a minus count. So while the rendezvous radar was jittering, it was just getting plus minus, plus minus, plus minus, plus minus, plus minus as it went back and forth. Internally, the computer only has one adder. So every time it gets a plus or minus count, it has to stop executing its program and execute what they called an unprogrammed instruction, just a single memory cycle instruction that loaded a value from a location, added one to it or subtracted one to it, and wrote it back out. And this just happened in the middle of program flow, sort of like an interrupt, but it didn't have to save any context when that happened. They're also called cycle-stealing instructions. Roughly 15% of the processing time for the AGC was being stolen, and that was enough for the software to start getting backed up. The landing works on a two-second guidance period. So there's a task in the AGC called the servicer that basically gets state information in, calculates what it wants to do with the engines for the landing, writes all that out to the engines, and then updates the displays to the disky. And this task takes normally a little bit less than 2 seconds, and it started exactly every 2 seconds on the dot. And so what was happening was the servicer wasn't able to finish in time. So the servicers were stacking up. Sometimes the display would go blank because that's the last thing the servicer does. So they would get to the point where they had, you know, 3-4 servicers running. And once that happened, when they tried to start another servicer, they would run out of available slots to have another servicer running. And that's what causes a 1201 or a 1202.
So, was it they also had left the abort guidance radar on as well as the landing radar? Was that another thing that contributed?
So that's a sort of a popular misconception. The problem was because they had the rendezvous radar on, but it was according to the checklist. It wasn't an error or anything like that. It's just that they got really unlucky. They did know about this before the flight. It had been observed, I want to say, in 1968 at Cape Canaveral on LEM 2, I think, during testing. George Silver from MIT wrote a report to it about it, and filed this report at Grumman. But Grumman and MIT weren't getting along very well at the time, so they didn't really pay attention to it. And the people that knew about this problem didn't really get together with the people that knew how bad it was, the software guys. And so, you know, just confluence of events.
What's the long-term plan with this particular computer? We've got two items here. Are they two separate computers, or are they a combined unit?
This is all one computer. The half on my right here just kind of flips over and plugs into the top of this one. So it's just broken up into two trays, the logic tray and the memory tray. The modules are inside, and then each tray has its own backplane that are sort of like on the outside of the computer.
I mean, it looks pretty solid, so I suspect when it's powered up, it would generate a fair bit of heat as well.
Yeah, I think it's about 70 watts when it's running.
So what's the plan for this computer? I think you said the other day, the longer-term aim is to fire it up.
That's right, yeah. We're hoping to bring this back online, turn it on for the first time in something like 50 years. It'll be really awesome if we do it, but like I said, we have a lot of homework before we do that. Understanding what all of the circuits were in it, like all the wires, was the first step, but now we have to assess the health of everything.
So, I mean, this is really computer archaeology. I mean, have you had much involvement with people from the time who designed it and built it?
Yeah, so actually a lot of our documentation came from original developers. In particular, more than half of the programs that we're running and all of our schematics that we have for the memory tray came from AGC developer Don Isles, who wrote the descent guidance for the landing.
Wow. Well, that's really fascinating. I'm going to take a few photos after this and we'll share them out. But listen, thank you so much. You look like you're about... You weren't around when they landed on the moon, I take it. So you, yep. This is a side project for you?
Yeah, this is just a hobby. It's a passion project of mine. I've been studying this computer for the past 4 or 5 years. This is my first opportunity to be hands-on on a real one. So I've answered a whole lot of questions that I've been building up for the past few years. This is an incredible opportunity.
So we're at the telemetrics booth. Is this a project, like, is this a company? Is this a private project? Is this something that's being funded by you or some voluntary group or a commercial operation?
So telemetrics is a company. They're building replica diskies, which were the display and keyboard for this computer. They're just sort of letting me and the owner of this computer crash in their booth. So I'm not much involved with telemetrics directly.
And what's your own story? What's your background and what do you do for a job?
For the past 7 years, I've been doing flight software at various space companies. Started out working on a lunar lander, and then I did some imaging satellites, and now I'm working on a small synthetic aperture radar satellite.
Fantastic. Well, this is just a wonderful project. And so is there like a website or a Facebook page that we can track the progress?
So the best website for this stuff is the virtual AGC website. That's ibiblio.org/Apollo. Ibiblio is ibiblio.org/Apollo.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us on the Space Show. It's fascinating. We look forward to having the big fire up in a few years' time whenever that happens. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was my interview at Spacefest, talking about the Apollo guidance computer. We've only got a short amount of time left. After we left Spacefest, we went over to the Kennedy Space Center, and we did a few interviews there. And this interview is about the crawler transporter, that big crawler machine that moves the rockets out to the launch pad.
And we're back then. Where are we, and what is this big thing above me?
We are standing under one of our crawler transporters here at Kennedy Space Center. It's one of the behemoth machines that we use to move the mobile launcher and the Space Launch System rocket out to the pad.
Right, and this was originally built for the Apollo program and then used after that as well.
Yeah, it was initially designed for the Apollo program. The engineers came up with it then. It's over 50 years old. It's been used for shuttle. And we refurbished it now to support the SLS rocket, which is a little bit more heavier than the previous two vehicles. So several refurbishments took place in support of this upcoming mission.
Right, and something we noticed when we pulled up this, the two of them are here, one side beside the other. This one underneath is actually raised up about another, 10 or 15 feet.
So recently the crawler transporter, which is currently above us, went out to Pad 39B for our verification and validation testing. When the crawler transporter is operated, it puts a lot of stress on the vehicle. So we're bringing it back here now, and they're doing a preventive maintenance checks on it, making sure all the hydraulic systems still work, checking the oil, the pressure, all the tracks are still good. So that's currently what's going on right now. That's why you see it raised up and a lot of parts spewed around. So.
Right, so there's four gigantic sort of crawler or caterpillar tracks. Any idea how much each of those cleats weigh?
Roughly each cleat weighs about 2 tons, excuse me. Each cleat weighs about 2 tons. There are several on each leg of the crawler, and when a crawler is fully loaded, it goes at about 0.8 miles an hour out to Pad 39B. When it's unloaded, it moves at about 2 miles an hour, so it's an arduous journey. We're not talking about a Corvette here. And,
And it doesn't look particularly economical. I guess the mileage is not too good on this one.
I wouldn't call it a hybrid vehicle, but it does the job. Obviously, there are a lot of engines that go into moving such a massive rocket. Mobile launch is roughly weighing at about 11 million pounds right there, and you put the SLS rocket on top of it. there's a lot of weight that this crawler transporter has to support. So the hydraulic system has to be extremely maintained, and the engines, it's a very cautious operation when we're moving the vehicles and the equipment out to the pad.
Well, fantastic. Once again, a great reuse of equipment that was originally built back in the Apollo days and for the shuttle. So fantastic.
And that was Peter in conversation at the Kennedy Space Center. Thanks for coming in, Peter.
Pleasure.
And over now to Nick Black and Pebble Hayes.